You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
Thank you so much. What an absolute pleasure to be here in this space with you all. Thank you for joining us here. Get cozy. We're going to have a lovely session. I've got a very lovely guest with me today. And I'm going to start by telling you a story. And that story is about my little brother. Who here's got a brother or siblings? I've got a lot of brothers. But this one in particular, his name's Mez. And he's quite a lot younger than me. He's 20. Yet I still go to him for advice, always. He's very wise. And the reason that I think he has so much wisdom is because the first chunk of his life until he was 12 years old looked very different from mine. He had a very different upbringing from me, very different experience as a child. And this is because Mez is my foster brother. He was born in a country called Eritrea. And in Eritrea, a country that I knew very little about before Mez joined my family, they have compulsory military service. And Mez had a very loving family, a mum and a dad and an older brother and little siblings as well. But he grew up with this fear of knowing that ultimately the day would come that he would have to go into the army and that he would have to fight for a dictatorship that he didn't believe in, that didn't represent him, that his father was already in prison for fleeing the army. His older brother was in the army, and it was something that Mez carried a real fear of. And Mez tells the story of when that day came. He was 12 years old. He was playing football with his two best friends up outside of their village. And they saw the army coming towards their village, and they knew that it was their time. They knew that they were of the right age and that they had to make a decision in that split second. They had to decide whether to stay and be conscripted or whether to run. Now, as I said, Mez was 12. He was with his two best friends, Nahom and Johannes. They'd grown up together. Mez says that everybody in his village knew everybody. They had a real strong sense of community. It was a small village, and that when he was growing up, if he was naughty, any of the mums in the village would tell him off. But if he fell over, any of the mums in the village would pick him up and dust his knees and give him a cuddle. And so the three of them made the decision in that moment to run. They ran to the next village where they were told, you can't stay here, it's not going to be safe for you here. So they continued until they crossed the border of Eritrea into Ethiopia. At this point, Mez, Nahom and Johannes became refugees. Now, Mez says that he didn't know what that word meant. He never thought that he would be a refugee. He didn't know that Eritrea was the country in Africa where most refugees were coming from, that many others had made this same journey before him, and they found themselves in a refugee camp full of Eritrean refugees, full of people that had fled the dictatorship in his country. And only then did he start to really understand the depth and the breadth of the situation in his country. Now, although the other people that were more established in the camp, they supported Mez and his friends with the supplies that they had, and they gave them food, and Mez realized very quickly that this wasn't a place that he could stay. He had a dream, Mez, always, to continue his education, to go to school, to go to university. And it became very apparent very quickly that in this camp on the border of Eritrea and Ethiopia, that was not going to be possible for him. So him, Nahom and Johannes, they decided to continue. Now, another reason why they decided to continue from Ethiopia is because they wanted to tell their mums, their parents, that they were safe, that they were alive. But they weren't able to do that from Ethiopia because Eritrea and Ethiopia were at war at the time. There was no phone communication between the two. So after about 6 weeks, they made it to Sudan, the next country on their journey, where Mez called his mum for the first time. And he says that she was so overcome with emotion at hearing his voice, having not known what had happened to him, having not known whether her son, her 12-year-old boy, was alive, that she she had to take a minute, that her neighbour had to take over and talk to Mez, because she was so emotional about the decision that he'd been faced with. But she knew too that there was no future for him in Eritrea, and she encouraged him to continue until he could find that place where he could just be, that he could be safe. Now, the boys found the situation in Sudan very difficult too. And so they made not really a decision, and Mez always says this, that he didn't really have a choice in the matter, that they did the only thing that they could do really, is which was continue, that they realized they couldn't stay there, they couldn't go back. So they continued with a hope for something that would be better. But the next step of their journey was crossing the Sahara Desert, which Mez says is the most difficult part of his journey. It took them 14 days. They had very little water, barely any food. And one of Mez's friends, Nahom, he died in the desert. And the two boys continued alone, Mez and Johannes, until they made it to Libya. From Libya, they crossed the Mediterranean Sea. Mez is the only one of his three friends that made it to Europe. After their boat capsized, he was pulled from the water by the Italian Coast Guard, taken to Italy, wrapped in an emergency blanket, given a protein bar. And you would think, like Mez thought, although he knew very little about Europe, that once he did make it to the shores of Europe as a child, that there would be a support network for him, that there would be someone there to keep him safe, give him a roof over his head. But Mez lived on the street in Rome for a few days until he continued to France, where he lived in the Calais jungle. Who has heard of the Calais jungle? Who knows about? Great. Okay, so maybe you've got an image of it in your mind. Mez says that he was shocked to see such conditions in Europe, that the situation in Calais was more difficult than the camps that he'd been in Eritrea, in Sudan. And so he realized too very quickly that he couldn't stay there. So Mez followed other Eritreans before him who had also advised him in Italy, you know, you can't stay here, because if you do, try and seek asylum here in Italy. Although maybe there isn't war in Italy, it's still not safe for you to seek asylum because people are being deported. And that was something that Mez was very scared of having his asylum denied, of not getting asylum, of being deported back to Eritrea. So he followed what other people were doing. And one day in the summer of 2015, he hid underneath the Eurotunnel train and made it to the UK. He was found by Kent police, who passed him on to Kent social services. They gave him some food and some warm clothes because his clothes were wet. And they asked him a really important question. They asked him, do you want to go to supported accommodation with other boys your age? Or do you want to go to a family? And they were using a translator because Mez didn't speak any English. And Mez didn't know anything about the foster system in the UK, about asylum or the immigration process that he would have to go through. But he did know one thing. He knew in his heart that every single day since he'd left, which had been 9 months that he'd been on this journey, he'd been yearning and longing for his family, his mum, his little siblings. That was one thing that he was sure about, that he wanted family. He wanted to be part of a family. So he said, family, please put me with a family. And that day, it was a Sunday, Kent Social Services called my mum and dad. It still makes me emotional to think about this day, but they called my mum and dad, who had just come to the end of their own 9-month journey. And Mez became my little brother that day. So Mez joined my family in 2015, changed the course of all of our lives. I didn't know anything about the journey that he would then go on to. I lived in a little bubble of not really knowing that there were so many unaccompanied children arriving to our shores, having to go through the process of seeking asylum and having been through unimaginable experiences and horrors. And I didn't know anything about Calais apart from what I was reading in the news, things like swarms of migrants and marauding migrants. And like, this is the only thing that these dehumanizing terms was all I had really been exposed to. Bearing in mind this was a while ago. And so I had a curiosity, because what I was reading didn't really seem to represent this kid that had joined my family, this boy who not only was victim to his circumstance in Eritrea, but also a hero, that he had experienced all that and gone through so much. And he was 12 years old, just to get to the same point of going to school and having a roof over his head and having food. And so I decided to go to Calais, and I started working in Calais. And it really, as I say, that first experience of going there, it really changed the course of my life, hearing stories firsthand, not just from Eritrea, from Sudan, from Afghanistan. And stories that did not feel represented by our media. I remember a time not long after that where I was standing in line for the bank in Tunbridge, and I could hear two women speaking in front of me about what was happening in Calais, and they said, oh, it's so dangerous there. People are running around with knives. And again, I thought about my little brother, and I thought about the disconnect between the reality and the idea and the perception. And I really wanted to interject and to tell them about my little brother. And I felt like I didn't have the words. And I left that bank feeling this sense of, this needs to be addressed. And so in the last 8 years, I've been on a real mission. And addressing that has taken many different forms, from making films to sharing infographics and information with our lovely social media network under the umbrella of Asylum Speakers, with the help of many people with lived experience, working alongside people in Calais and beyond, in Greece and in Turkey. And I've had the absolute pleasure of meeting some of the most incredible people with the most incredible stories. And this book is a collection of 30, it's actually 31 of them. It was supposed to be 30 stories. But then I met a boy called Giel, who is the last story in this book, who I couldn't leave out. He's South Sudanese, he's 18 years old, and he just has the most incredible story that I won't go into today. But these people, they really, really have shaped and inspired and expanded my perspective and my mind in so many ways. And one of them is sitting on this stage with me, Gawali. Some of you might know him already. He's itching to introduce himself. So I'm very, very, very honored and proud to be sharing this stage with you, Gawali. And maybe you can introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about your story.
Thank you, Jazz. Welcome to Kettering, and welcome you all to Kettering. I'm a local from Kettering. It's great to be here. This is my second time. Last time I was speaking over there, which was great. So I'm the author of this book, The Lightless Sky. Jazz didn't mention, but actually she ended up doing all she has done because she was impacted by this book. And she was inspired by it, I hope. Yeah.
Can I tell a really quick story about your book?
Yeah.
If you haven't heard enough of my voice already, but I have four foster brothers now. So Mez was the first of four. He's Eritrean. The second one was Sudanese. The third one's Afghan. And during that time, when my Afghan brother joined my family, all of my family passed around Gawali's book. And I'm so grateful to you. I know I've said this to you before, but I will continue to say it to you.
Her to not forget that. Yeah.
Because it really gave us an insight into what he had experienced and what he would experience in the UK. And I really feel that it made his integration process easier, having had this as a resource and your experience understanding it and knowing it. And I know that sharing such a story is not an easy thing to do, but I hope that you know the impact that it has had on a very tangible level for my Afghan brother, who is now six years into life in England and doing very well.
Wonderful. Well, there you go. Thank you very much. What else can I say? So I'm a humanitarian. I apparently became an author by accident, and I've been going around raising awareness, trying to advocate and campaign for refugees' rights. I first heard of Jazz in 2015 when he went to Calais, and didn't realize that we would be friends a few years down the line. I look up to her like a sister, maybe. We're similar age, but I call her a big sister. But anyway, and then, I'm really pleased to be joined her on the stage and to have a bit of a conversation, and especially what is happening now in the world, in the UK. Just this morning, I read an article where unaccompanied minors are sent to jails and sent to prisons with sex offenders. And we are at a stage where asylum seekers, the Home Secretary was saying that she will deport asylum seekers because otherwise this will be a pull factor for children to come to the UK to seek protection. So we are at a very unprecedented time. The way the UK was always hostile when it comes to government and policies and refugees. I came here in 2007. Things weren't great. It took me 2-3 years to challenge social services over my age dispute. My nationality was disputed by the Home Office. The whole story is in the Lightless Sky. Those of you who have read it, thank you. If you haven't, please do read it. And also, actually, there's a story, some of the story in Jazz's book also. But, you know, we're at a time where we have the Nationalities and Borders Act last year, or the year before, creating a two-tier system of good refugees, bad refugees, the deserving and undeserving. And then if that wasn't good enough, then we had an illegal migration bill. We have the cruel Rwanda deportation policy. We have this, you know, we want to put people in badges. The government has been doing everything it can to be cruel and to create this inhumane laws where it will keep people in limbo. It will detain people in detention and put them in military bases. This I don't believe that represents us as Britain. I've been here for 16 years. I travel across the UK, and the people that I've met, the experience I had, has nothing but kindness and generosity and compassion. Thank you. So I feel like what the government is doing does not represent us, but sadly they have been in power for the last 13 years. And I think their main election slogan next year would be stopping the boat, even though that's not practically possible. The boat is as a result of this government, or partially because of Brexit. There's a lot of things in there, but you know, there's an assumption that these refugees or asylum seekers, people like me or Mez or others, have choice, have options. There are a very small number of people in Calais, a few thousand people at times, who wants to come to the UK for all sorts of reasons. And this idea that we expect people to go anywhere but Britain doesn't make sense. And when they come here, because we can shift them 6,000 miles to Rwanda. And you know, we see people like me as a threat and these guys who were put on a badge. I had a friend there, and he was saying to me that, you know, he's been punished for something that he has not done. He's been made of an example of, and he'd been kept in that place in a floating prison, basically. And we saw with the whole situation of the safety and the diarrhea and so on, and the health and safety aspects of it. But it's just that we are at a stage where the government wants to go after people who are the most vulnerable in society. Instead of helping and supporting them, instead of protecting them, we rather punish them and penalize them and criminalize them for coming here to seek protection. So this is where we are. I don't want to depress you, but I hope you'll have a conversation about that and how we can challenge this hostility and how this does not represent us and what are we going to do about it. Because we're at a stage where France takes 4 or 5 times more asylum application than Britain. Germany takes 7. Last year, Germany had 300,000 asylum application. Britain had about 65,000 or so. And consecutively, we've been getting about 30,000 people. We have a backlog of 175,000. It was announced the other day. It's not that because we're getting a lot more people. It's just the government, the Home Office, decided not to make decisions. And the immigration minister says this is purposely done to demonstrate that Britain is not a welcoming place, because they want people to be in limbo. They want people to be, and then want us to all be angry about, you know, costing £6 million a day, putting people in hotels. These asylum seekers don't want to be in hotels. I see them, these guys. Most of us would not stay in these hotels where asylum seekers are staying. It's the government has put us in this situation where they want the public to be angry about the whole hotel situation, the boats, the invasion, and as Jazz said, the dehumanizing language and then criminalizing people. So if the government does enact this act of illegal migration act, basically the Home Secretary has a duty by law to detain and remove anybody who arrives irregularly. And this idea of illegal arrival doesn't make sense, because claiming asylum, no matter how you arrive, you are an asylum seeker, that's perfectly legal. There is no alternative routes, and so these routes that currently exist, which are dangerous and irregular, that will continue. We will be getting, you know, we will be having 30, 40, 50,000 people in prison, in detention centers, and basically the UKs want to spend millions and billions. They spend billions on the badge. They want to spend more billions on building detention facility, and it will be much cheaper to house people and treat them with compassion and kindness and solidarity than what we are doing.
Gowali.
Sorry, you're asking for an introduction. I've told you something else.
Got carried away, didn't you? We were getting there. But can we go back a little bit? Can we rewind to the beginning? And can you share a little bit about, you also left when you were 12, right, from Afghanistan, and also had a very difficult journey. Are you happy to share a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. So I left alongside my brother because of the conflict and the war in Afghanistan, and we were being forced to flee. You know, sometimes people ask me, oh, why did you come and how did you come? Like, I was a child. I didn't have much of a choice. I didn't have much of a decision-making power. But anyhow, my mother and particularly my grandmother decided to send us away because we were being pursued by the Taliban to join them to become fighters or to join the Afghan government, wanted us to work for them. And funny enough, now looking back, if I have stayed, I may have a really important job. If I have survived, I could have a really important job in the current regime, you know, who knows. And it really, you know, it really frustrates me that, you know, I've lost loved one to the war. I'm going again on a different tangent. 150,000 Afghans lost their lives, sadly, and 75,000 Afghan security forces were killed in the 4 years alone, from 2016 till 2020. The sacrifices for what? If the US were going to hand over Afghanistan to the Taliban, to a much more... So basically, the Taliban have been replaced with a much more equipped and modernized Taliban, basically. They have billions worth of weapons and machinery, which they did not have in 2001. My loved ones will still be alive if the US and Britain had not invaded Afghanistan. Somehow, in 2001, 2005, 2010, Afghan women's rights were important, and certainly in 2022, 2021, 2020, it became irrelevant. So we are at a stage where I'm just angry that Afghanistan and Afghans were abandoned by the West. And then when Afghans come here to seek protection, we want to detain them. We want to send them to Rwanda. We want to basically put them in a barge. It just doesn't make sense to me. It's very, very... And also, I just read an article this afternoon that last year or this year, the UK only welcomed 430 people or so. They were supposed to bring 5,000 Afghans. They only brought 400. Last year, there was like 44 or something. And there are still the six... There were 8,000 Afghans in hotels, costing us £1 million a day for the last 2 years. Only some of them have managed to leave, but most of them are basically have been evacuated from these hotels, accommodations, are going to be sadly homeless or go to some temporary accommodation. So yeah, my story was such that I traveled across half of the world. I was supposed to be with my brother. We were separated by the smugglers. And, you know, people said to me, why the UK? And I used to explain why the UK, because my brother was supposedly here and I was unwelcomed elsewhere, everywhere else except Italy. If it weren't for my brother, I would have stayed in Italy because they treated me well. In Greece, I was in prison. In Turkey, in Iran, in Bulgaria, I was in prison, deported. Even in France, I had a very terrible time in Calais, being tear gassed and shoes being taken away by the police. Our tents been burned down. And now I realize this is done with British taxpayer money, that we give money to the French to harass refugees. And once I was actually challenged by a BBC journalist saying that I can't say this, that we give money to the French to harass refugees. That's not why we give them money. I said, why do we give them money? I said, look, maybe we don't specifically say in the contract to harass refugees, but we tell them to stop these refugees coming to the UK. So, you know, nevertheless, I made this journey. And for me, I tell people, why not the UK? Because when people say to me, why the UK? Why do we have this British exceptionalism that we expect Afghans or other refugees to go elsewhere? Like, basically, Britain is not in the top 10 countries for hosting refugees. We're not even in the top 20 for hosting refugees. When it comes to per capita for population, Britain is like 25th in the world. And, you know, we host less than 1% of the world refugees here. But in the last 2 years, Britain have actually welcomed about 500,000 Ukrainians and Hong Kongers, which is really wonderful, but no one says a thing. That safe passage, I mean, it's positive. You know, I was in Poland last year, and this year earlier, I was in Chisinau in Moldova. The plane was full of Ukrainian families and children, and as a refugee rights campaigner, I was very touched. But that is not available to anybody else. In the minister recently, one of the ministers was asked, and GB News, Good morning, Britain. it's the same thing. He was asked, why are we able to do this for the Ukrainians and not for anybody else? He said, oh, these two different things, different situation. No, there is this institutional racism. And I'm not saying we should make it more difficult for the Ukrainians and the Hong Kongers, but I'm saying, why can't this be done for Afghans, for Eritreans, for Sudanese, for Somalians? Thank you. I mean, you know, the government spends so much money and resources, and we give 120 million to Rwanda to take a few hundred people just to make a point. You know, the Home Secretary made more trips to Rwanda than send refugees there. I mean, it's funny, but it's not even funny. You know, so we're at a stage where it's, you know, the government is using our money in ways that I think it's completely unjustifiable. And I think we need to make a stand, and somehow we need to explain that this is not okay. If the same resources and money and energy were spent to help and support refugees, we'll be in a completely different place. These guys, some of these Afghans, for example, or other refugees, asylum seekers, they want to work. At the moment, they're not allowed to work. They had to live on £5 a day. If they're in hotels, they get £8, £9 a week. They don't want to be in that situation, you know, to not be, you know, they have lost their self-esteem, their confidence. And I could go on and on, but I feel like, you know, the asylum system is broken, but it's the government who broke it. And they're trying to blame and scapegoat refugees for all the failures of this government. And we need to not let them get away with it. Sorry, I speak fast.
I'm right there with you, Gawali. I'm right there with you. What time are we on? Okay, brilliant, because I want to have some time to have some discussion around this. So hopefully you guys have got some questions, and if not, think of some, because Gawali and I could talk about this for a long time. But there's a couple of points based on what you said that I just wanted to make. So going back to Afghanistan and Afghans, it's not really in our news very much at the moment. And I remember the first person I met when I went to Calais was an Afghan man who spoke very good English. And I remember asking him, oh, where did you learn such incredible English? And he said, I was a translator with the British Army, and that's why I'm going to the UK. And this book highlights some of the questions, as well as 30 stories. It aims to answer some of those common misconceptions or questions that we see coming up online, things like, but why do people want to come to the UK? Why don't they stay in the first safe country? Why are refugees all men? And all of those questions are addressed in the book and through the work that we do.
We like people to ask these questions, but if they're genuinely asking to understand, then yes, we can answer. But usually they ask it for other reasons and other purposes. You know, they don't want to understand. They don't want to know. They just want to make a point. Otherwise, we can explain.
And we're very happy to always engage in conversation and share on a story level. And I think that I've really seen that for me, meeting Mez was the catalyst to me becoming active. From passive to active was that personal relationship and meeting someone firsthand. And then when I went on to meet more people like Gawali, who then became not scary, nothing that I was afraid of, and I started to understand things better. I really feel that getting to the root of this issue is about education and awareness, and stories are a really powerful way to understand and encourage empathy. So as I say, Gawali's book is a very, very amazing place to start. I had a couple of other points as well whilst you were talking, but they've gone out of my mind.
Oh, I'm sorry, Jazz. you know, there's some people like Fran here and Martin, they're great people. I went a few times to Darlington to speak at events around, you know, encouraging people to become foster carers. Like, usually people ask what they could do, which I'm sure we'll come to, but, you know, things that we could do, writing to our MP, even though it might be a useless exercise, but it's nevertheless showing. So I met the MP for Kettering in Parliament last year. There was a demonstration, and he's quite right-wing. Actually, he's so UKIP that UKIP didn't stood a candidate against him, but he's a nice guy. he met me and I said, why are you doing this? Why are you voting for this Nationalities and Border Act? And you know this is not going to solve the problem. It will just create a two-tier system. And actually, the government now made a U-turn on it, because what is the point of having two-tier system where you if people come here irregularly, you don't give them the right kind of status, you don't give them the
Can you explain a little bit more about this two-tier system?
So it's like if you come through resettlement, you're a good refugee, you can get all the support and help, which is a very small percentage of people who comes through resettlement. But most people come irregularly. That's the only route, unless, as I said, if you're from Ukraine or Hong Kong.
Because if you are Afghan or Sudanese or Eritrean, I don't know of any.
I mean, there's an Afghan resettlement scheme in name only. They're supposed to take 5,000 people. You can't apply for it. You have to be somehow selected. There's three ways you could do it. One is through being referred by UNHCR. Other is through agencies and organization that you have worked with are linked to Britain. Actually, 17,000 Afghans are issued with visas. They're stranded in Pakistan for the last 2 years. There are some statistics say about 200,000 Afghans are eligible to come to the West, not necessarily the UK, but the Europe, in the America, and other places. They have were somehow involved. So
just to simplify that, for many nationalities, most nationalities, there are no legal routes.
No. I mean, again, I have an issue with the word legal routes in itself, because claiming asylum is not illegal in itself. The UN Convention on Refugees is very clear. Humanitarian laws are very clear. But the UK government has... But the UK government has criminalized it. So my friend Shafiq, he came here last September. He was imprisoned for illegal entry for 12 months. So this is a reality that people are not even aware of. He spent 6 months in Medestun in Her Majesty prison, or His Majesty prison. And he's released on bail. He goes to probation every week for signing. He's walking around with a tag. So the government is constantly reminding him that they're watching him. They're surveying on him. And he's in constantly being, you know, this situation. He goes to a signing every week to the Home Office as well. Like, this idea of probation is that you don't commit a crime again, or you don't go through. Like, what is he going to commit? Come to the UK regularly again? Or, you know, so it's just like, what crime has he committed? So we are at a stage where it's ridiculous that we actually, instead of helping and supporting asylum seekers, we're going to imprison them. Anyway, so yeah, writing to MP is important. It helps. Going down demonstration, coming to talks like this, reading books like ours, and fostering if you can, befriending refugees, mentoring them, going to Calais in Greece, elsewhere to volunteer with refugees and see it for yourself. You know, these are our fellow human beings. We ought to help and support them. And if we can't help and support them, at least be kind and compassionate in our approach towards them. We can't just like say, oh, these are a bunch of migrants, these are illegals, you know, these are criminals, and you know, they're invading our countries. The language that the government has been using, they have made these right-wing ideas mainstream. It has become acceptable, I would say, since Brexit and since this government, since Priti Patel and Suala Braverman, to use this kind of language, which was completely unacceptable a few years ago. Yes, there was a culture of disbelief, there was a culture of hostility, but now there's laws of hostility and deterrence. It was just used to be, you know, a different system and policy, but now we are a country, the only country actually in Europe, where we detain people indefinitely, where now I know it's so much for like women's rights. Britain is building a new detention facility in Durham for women. There's already quite a few, it already exists, and the condition there is terrible. Yarl's World was there was a really good documentary on Yarl's World, how women were being abused and treated there by the guards and so on. So we take pride in our human rights, and we ask the question, where are the women? Well, even though when the women do make it here, we put them in a detention centers.
So just to finish up before we have some questions, thank you for calling me out on the semantics of legal and illegal. And I want to expand on that slightly about the semantics that we are using, because this is something that we can really take away immediately, is really considering the words that we use. And even the words refugee, asylum seeker, immigrant, illegal immigrant have been hijacked and used in our media as a negative. Whereas asylum seeker, it's someone seeking safety. And it seems that, like, that is literally the meaning of it, but it seems that that has been lost in our current rhetoric. So instead of using these, I would encourage everybody here to replace those terms whenever you see them with the words brother or sister or mother or father or son or daughter, because everybody is someone's son or daughter, and everybody was held in somebody's arms as a baby. And that's what I would really encourage us all to take away. And it's an easy thing for us all to do.
Agree. I think, you know, language matters in the way we use it. Sometimes we use it with good intentions. Like, you know, I've been saying, oh, we need legal and safer and legal routes. And the government has actually taken on this for the last few years. They used to not like the word legal. So now they use it for all their terrible policies. They say, oh, we're going to provide legal, safe and legal routes. But they just use that terminology, which we in the refugee sectors used to use. But it's problematic. Like, you cannot substitute. No matter how somebody arrives, you got to consider their asylum claim. Yes, of course, you know, before Brexit, we had a deal with the EU. We could send people back. I disagree with it, but it was a system in place. But now we don't have that. And, you know, if people come here, I see people on social media saying, you know, recently the people, six Afghan drowned in the channel. Oh, if they were coming here, they knew the risk. So they took the risk. And, you know, that's what happens if you take a risk. I'm like, if you can't help people, let's not be so miserable. Let's not be so, you know, out of touch as human beings. And, like, people said, I wrote an article saying the British government had a blood on its hand. I done like 20 interviews. Instead of asking me about the people who died, they were asking me about my comments. Is it justified to call the British government have blood on its hand? I said, you know, let's not discuss what I said. Let's discuss what has happened. Like, why are you more interested in what I said and not interested in people losing their lives because of our policies and laws? People, the more you make it difficult for people to come, you know, we spent £250 million in Calais on securitization. Lorries and trucks were dangerous. I came through a refrigerator truck, but it was not as dangerous as small boats. So they actually, people suggesting, saying, oh, we should turn people away. We should not risk diplomacy. What they're saying is, it's okay for these people to drown. And that's the time we're living in. As I said in the beginning, I don't want to depress you, but it's a very depressing situation that we face with. Thousands and thousands of people who come to our shores for safety will be in limbo, are currently in limbo. 175,000 people waiting for a decision, particularly Afghans over there, like five nationalities. They usually have a very high acceptance rates. Why are we keeping them in limbo? Why are we, like, why are we spending millions? And also, I just remembered, the £6 million that we spend on this money, somebody recently said, a minister said that, oh, this money could be spent for schools or something else. Actually, this money is taken from the foreign aid budget. So this money is not taken from anything else. It's still problematic because Afghanistan, they cut about 60-70% budget to Afghanistan. Right now, we're going through a humanitarian crisis where 24 million people don't have enough to eat, where about last year, about 8 to 10 million people were experiencing famine. In the beginning of the takeover of the Taliban, about 4,000 children were dying a month due to malnutrition. And the UNHCR says about 1.5 million Afghans have fled the country in the last 2 years. So just yesterday, I watched the minister of whatever they call, the minister of virtues, something. He went to Bamiyan, which is a historical province, and there's a really beautiful national park, and Bandi Amir, where there's a lake and there's like a beautiful place. People go there for leisure, and he says, women are not allowed to come here no more. So they have stopped women from working. They have stopped girls from school, from age of after year six. They have stopped girls from universities. Now they have stopped women from going to the public parks earlier on in Kabul. But this specific place where people go there for leisure and go there for a break, they said women were not allowed. So imagine we are at this stage where the British government argued. I listened to the former British Army Chief of Staff. He said, give the Taliban a break. Give them some time. You know, they have changed. And, you know, here we are. There were people in London and Washington lobbying for them. The US literally signed a deal with them and handed Afghanistan over to them. And now we are surprised. And so, you know, I'm just angry with what has happened in Afghanistan. And, you know, we're at the stage where really the British government needs to take its responsibility seriously and do what it can to help and support Afghans as well as other refugees. And we need to have better system in place. You cannot stop boats unless you give people alternatives. You can blame the smugglers and agents and traffickers, whatnot. They exist as a business model. They will not exist. Why aren't the Ukrainians taking small boats? Because there is no need for it. Why aren't the Hong Kongers taking the small boats? Because they can come through alternative, safe passage. They can come through humanitarian corridors. Unless we create a visa system for humanitarian purposes, a humanitarian visa or some sort of safe passage, people will still come and sadly people will die because of how much we have made it difficult. Because people say we're a soft touch. If Britain was a soft touch, people would not be drowning in the channel.
Great question. So if Mez was arriving today, age 12, would he be deported at the age of 18? So just to give you a little bit of my understanding of the asylum process with my four brothers. All of them applied for asylum, at which you're hoping to get 5 years leave to remain. And then you apply again after 5 years. So three of them were accepted. My Afghan brother was denied his asylum. He was 14 and he was given a flight details, or like he was due to be deported on his 16th, 17 and a half birthday. Anyway, because the grounds were that he didn't know the exact dates that the Taliban had come to his house when he was 11, or I don't even know, something crazy. So we had to appeal. Thankfully, he has the support of a family who understand the system, and my mum stood up in court, and it was very emotionally and mentally and physically difficult as a process to go through for him. You know, he just got to the point where he was at college, he was studying, he was learning English, he was sleeping better, and then he had to go through that whole process, just appeal to then be accepted. And it just felt so cruel to put this teenage boy through that at that age, and given what he had been through. But anyway, in answer to your question, I don't think that the asylum process for Eritreans or has changed that much since Mez has arrived. Once you get to the UK, so as an unaccompanied minor, you would still go through the same process, and the chances are that as an Eritrean, you would get accepted, right?
But with the new legislation, it says everyone, and as soon as, Fran have a very good question, as soon as somebody turns 18, the Home Secretary have an obligation by law to deport them, to send them to their own country of origin, or to send them to...
But they're not deporting anyone to Eritrea.
They're deporting, well, this is the thing, they're not deporting Afghans to Afghanistan, but keeping people in limbo. They will try to send them to Rwanda or somewhere else. The thing is this, it's unpractical. It does not work. It just virtue signaling. And one thing, Fran, they will do, the Home Office has been doing, if Ms. or I arrive today or yesterday or tomorrow, they will age dispute me, and the Home Office will give me a date of birth which will say that I'm over 25. So they've been doing this to so many Afghans. As soon as you arrive, you say you're 14, 15, 16, whatever, they will tell you. They used to say you look over 18. Now that's not the case. They have a policy where you shouldn't age dispute people unless they look over 25. So they've been telling people you're over 25, and then you have to go through a formal age assessment with local authority. But the Home Office is changing that. The Home Office will have its own social worker unit at the Home Office making decisions which cannot be overturned by anybody else. So before you could have make a decision in local authority, you had about 3 months to go through even judicial review, through courts, or try to prove your age through whatever identity documentation and so on. But now, anybody arriving, the Home Office age disputes you. If the Home Office social workers do an age assessment, there is nothing you could do about it. The Home Office starts with the premise that people like me and Ms. are lying, so we're not 13, 12, we're somehow 16 or 17 or whatever. And then you had to go through this process. Before, it was somewhat... I mean, you know, it took me 3 years to challenge that. It wasn't easy, but there was a system in place. But now, with the Home Office own social workers unit on site, and the Home Secretary under obligation to remove anyone who arrives irregularly, she said it in a statement the other day, or before the Parliament went to recess. She says she will deport unaccompanied minors. Not only when they get 18, she says she will deport them, because otherwise it will put the wrong precedent in terms of... More and more children will come. So not only she will deport them when they're 18, she will try to deport them whilst they're unaccompanied minors, unless they have family here, unless they have really good reasons to be allowed. And it's, again, I'm sorry, it's depressing, but it's where we are.
Right.
That's a very good point. So the lady is saying she's helping this Eritrean boy who came at 16, now he's 33. So this is the law. So when you are age disputed, when you are granted a temporary leave to remain until you are 18, you have to start all over again. You are refused and you have to somehow find a way to start over again. And you are in a limbo. So I know people 10 years, 12 years, they've been waiting. They're Afghans who finally got a status because of the Taliban situation. The Home Office always argued Afghanistan was safe and they were refusing Afghans. And suddenly they're saying, you know, it's okay. And now, even now, they're saying, yes, we can't deport you to Afghanistan, but we still wouldn't. There were an Afghan pilot who was sent a letter to be sent to Rwanda. He was a pilot. And so...
Thank you. Thank you so much. And absolutely, I mean, I'm still figuring that out myself. Yes, so this... point was about allyship and how it's our responsibility as anybody who isn't fighting for their safety every day, fighting for security every day, those of us who are comfortable enough to not have to deal with that, to fight for those that are. And what does that look like? It does look like getting uncomfortable, getting things wrong. And I've definitely been on this journey where, as I say very openly from the beginning, I didn't know anything about the asylum process or the asylum system, or I'm still learning as I go, and I definitely have blind spots, get things wrong, and have been on this journey quite openly online in saying that, like, I didn't know about this until I met this person and I listened, and I actively listened, and the podcast has been a really beautiful way for me to ask these questions. But absolutely, you are right that we should not be putting the emphasis on people with this lived experience to explain it to us. Although Gwali and I, we often do this together, these talks, because then it does help to, I mean, maybe you can speak on this, but I hope that where I can kind of create a safe space and some context, it's a more comfortable space for you to be able to share, because it is not an easy thing to do. And Mez and I often do these talks together too, my Eritrean brother, and I always try and speak first, and really I'm very connected to him, so I know how he is feeling, because sometimes these things are hard for him. But absolutely, it's all of our responsibility, and that can look many, many different ways. And as Gwali mentioned before, yes, you can volunteer in Calais, yes, you can foster or host a refugee through Refugees at Home, but also it doesn't need to look like that. It starts with education, and it starts with educating ourselves, and there are so many resources available to us to do that. Books, films, podcasts, you can listen, you can read, you can watch, and we can very happily share some of those resources that we, through the books, the podcast, the many films on, there is more and more resource that we don't have the excuse that this is far away and we don't know about it, because we all have this information at the tip of our fingers at all times. So even being here and listening to this and being in this space is a massive start. So thank you. And thank you for your point.
Thank you, sister. That was just to add on. Great, great point. Because this idea, like when I went to a peace protest on the Borders and Nationality Act, there were very few allies there. I saw mainly refugees and asylum seekers and migrants, which was good. But I think, you know, you're right. It's like the government is trying to do something in our name, or in the name of you guys. Although I'm a citizen, I'll tell you a funny story. I went to Afghanistan after 16 years. It wasn't funny anyway. I went to Afghanistan to see my mother. I was afraid of the Taliban. They're very unpredictable. But I was more worried coming back to Dubai and finding out that my passport or my citizenship is being revoked. So basically my concern was, of course, I was in the back of my mind, I was worried about the Taliban situation, but more so finding out that the Home Secretary, or coming back and finding out that the Home Secretary had revoked my citizenship. So with the Border and Nationality Act, even though it's been law for a long time, the Home Secretary were rarely using the power of depriving people of citizenship. And the first time recently it was done was Shamima Begum. And people was like, yeah, of course, she went to terrorists and she did this. And people didn't realize the repercussion and the precedent it set. If somebody was grown up here and was groomed here and was a child and then was taken to Syria, whatnot, they should face the justice, the law, the court, the system. But by denying them citizenship, it's such a cruel thing to do. Now she's actually stranded in Syria and they want to make it somebody else's problem. So anyway, even though I lived here for 16 years, I was a refugee for 5 years, I was kind of in limbo for 5 years, and then I was a settled person for some time, and then now I'm a citizen. But with these laws and legislation that we have, I feel very worried that the Home Secretary could any time take away my citizenship without even me knowing, because she has, or he could, if somebody else comes in, would have the power to remove my citizenship, and that's scary. So yeah, we need definitely allyship in this idea of you guys helping us, or, you know, refugees seen as victims. I think we have a moral obligation, and I think we have a duty as citizens, as human beings, that we need to understand what our government is doing in our name, particularly to the most vulnerable in society. Because, for example, I couldn't vote until now, until that I become a citizen. And there are you guys who could vote and still don't vote for the right type of people or the right type of party who could represent us, if there is any. So, you know, there is an obligation. And I feel like, you know, we what kind of a human would we be if you don't concern ourselves with the suffering and pain of our fellow human beings? I would not feel comfortable sitting here if somebody's in pain over there or over there. So in the same way that we need to support refugees and asylum seekers, not just to support them because, you know, we want to help and support them, which is the right thing to do, but also it's upon us because they have come to our country. We're citizens, and that's what, right now I have no issue. I could just live my life. I'm not a refugee anymore in the legal sense, but I'm still displaced. I'm still away from my family and loved ones. I could just get on with my life, so I shouldn't have to do what I'm doing, but I feel a sense of duty, a sense of an obligations that the least I could do is to raise my, you know, to share my experiences and raise awareness and trying to change things and get people to be more compassionate, to open their minds and heart, and for you guys to go from here and challenge other people who have these negative views. And this, there's so much misinformation out there. There's just so much nonsense, which is not true. You know, as I told you, Britain hosts less than 1% of the world refugees. But if you listen to the right-wing media, if you listen to some people, they will say, we have been overrun. We are too small. We are full. You know, the other day I was speaking to Radio Northampton. Somebody could message in saying, how dare you say such a thing. We are full. We can't take them. We don't want you. Why are you like imposing yourself on us? You know, but that's not the view of the majority of the British public. So therefore, you guys need to, you know, step up.
Yes.
Very good point.
It's a really good question. Just to repeat that.
You've got 2 minutes.
Okay. Really quick. Well, maybe this is a good place to end because maybe this is one that we discuss as a community. How do we reach those communities, those people that don't necessarily hold the same values around immigration? It's not an easy thing. We don't want to be just talking to the echo chamber. We don't want to just have this book in the hands of people that already agree with us, but all of us probably know someone. Maybe we have a family member. I know I do. A family member, a neighbor, somebody who we're connected with that might hold some different values or beliefs around this. And it is somewhere that you have something that you have to step lightly with because you don't want to alienate people. But stories, I really believe, are the way forward. That it is through stories that we learn these narratives and these ideas, and that we can start to challenge them. And maybe it is just a case of like, well, read this before we have this conversation around immigration. Read this story and then come back to me. Listen to this podcast with this person speaking about their personal experience, and then let's have this conversation, because then you're coming from an informed place, or a place that at least has some information from a first-hand perspective. But it's not an easy thing to answer. I wish I had the answer. We use social media a lot, and Gowali does a lot on the radio, and definitely a lot of people who don't agree with you get to hear what you're saying because he has a lot of negativity towards some of the, as you've mentioned today, right, that you have to channel and receive. But what we try and do is take that rhetoric, that negativity, and channel it into, okay, how can we continue in our work to inform and to educate? But we need all of your help on that for sure. And I'll leave it there, but if anyone has any more ideas on that, please
quickly,
let us know.
We'll finish.
Have last comment.
Thank you. If anybody else have questions, we will be around. Jazz is going to be sending books, and I'm going to be available to answer any questions. I'm just the extra bit, but I don't have copies of my book with me, but this is also our book. So this is a really important question, and I feel like us being here, the main objective should be, how do we... No, it's not persuading these guys, but understanding them. So I can sympathize and empathize with these guys because for too long, the government and the right-wing media have been telling them that I'm their enemy. They can't get a doctor appointment. They can't get a social housing. They can't get such and such thing. They can't get their kids to school. There's crime because of refugees and asylum seekers and whatever. But a lot of the time, it's easy to scapegoat someone and to blame them. Like we saw, there was a protest against the barge in Devon. There was two protests. One was against them because for the right reason. One was against them for different reasons, but there was some commonality. And I spoke to some people. I said, you know, we agree on something. You don't want the badge here. I don't want the badge here. Let's focus on that. You know? So, but I think, you know, every time I go, I've done about 600 talks across the UK, and usually my audience are supportive, kind people. Even if they're not kind, it's a British sense of, like, politeness not to tell me. But ultimately, we have to reach these people. I mean, we have to find a way to communicate and engage with them. Some might not want to engage. They just like to, you know, write stuff on social media. If they're so determined to go on a protest, you know, for all sorts of reasons. They have it in the back of their mind, and they see us as a threat, and we're taking over the country, and this and that. And but well, we have to start somewhere. We have to start the conversation, discussion with them, saying, look, you're blaming the wrong people. We need to be blaming the government, and you need to be making the government accountable and the cooperation and whatnot. There's like companies, G4S and other companies, who house asylum seekers in housing, makes billions and millions out of it. The energy prices are high. The companies are making billions, but you would rather blame asylum seekers staying in a hotel next door. Why don't you go and, like, why don't we all go and protest outside British Gas or Eons or whatever? So, or BNP or BP or Shell. So I feel like, you know, we need to channel that anger in the right directions. And I think it's difficult because we don't want to be telling them things. We need to have a discussion and conversation, try to understand their viewpoint, and then trying to explain our viewpoint to them. Because otherwise, if we're calling them Nazis and right-wingers and racists, they're not going to get us anywhere. Yes, there may be some people who are exactly that, but at the same time, there may be others who could come to some sort of common grounds with. We can say, look, we understand and appreciate your grievances, your struggles. Let's work on it. Let's find the source of the problem. Refugees and asylum seekers are not the problem. You will find us being doctors and nurses and teachers. We are not the ones basically at the end, you know, making your life difficult. So, but thank you for the question. We can continue this conversation. Thank you, everyone, for coming. And
thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.